dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. They were the voices of Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra. Again, introducing me the night he hosted The Tonight Show, and this is the voice that brings you John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, live from Las Vegas. As you all know, and as I like to do, I like to start the show usually making some humorous comments about the news or the human comedy to make us both smile, but frankly, sadly, I am in no mood for that today. First, the political scene is so depressing, it is beyond redemption. The quality of the two leading candidates would have to improve dramatically just to be considered pathetic. You know how mediocre this year's elections are when you see it getting lousy reviews on Yelp. Next to watching the Trump-Hillary campaign ads, the Kardashians is masterpiece theater. A number of folks, as you also know, a number of celebrities have said if either gets into office, they're leaving the country, and a few of what's left of the poor middle class have threatened to jump out of their basement windows. Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, take your choice. Sail the Titanic or fly the Hindenburg. Do you realize if Hillary becomes president, the Clintons and the Bushes would have run and ruined this country for 24 of 32 years. The Clintons and Bushes are less inspiring than the Hatfields and the McCoys. They are the Manson families of American politics. In this madhouse called America, at the risk of offending many of my friends, this was my first instinctive reaction to the carnage in Florida yesterday. First off, my instincts are seldom wrong, beginning with feeling the murders of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy were not lone nutters. Unlike Christian born-againers murdering innocent people at Planned Parenthood clinics, this Muslim was not killing Christians for religious reasons. He seems to be just a madman who hated homosexuals. And have you been watching or listening to the news today? You know what the media is now saying? They're saying that Omar was radicalized by the internet. Not only, meaning is gun control now on the oligarch's agenda, but so will be internet control. I do not see personally how Omar could become more homophobic looking at the internet, which is mostly heterosexual porn anyway. But I can see him being upset by the very large numbers of homosexuals, which people almost every show on television. For the media to make this a Muslim murderer is a crime. Now I can see an American soldier in a secure bunker in Fort Bragg launching a drone into a wedding party in Afghanistan or Pakistan, which they have done and still do, killing innocent people. But I do not see how one deranged man can get into a club and murder 50 people by himself. They buried Muhammad Ali on Friday, and as I posted, I am deeply, deeply saddened by the death of Ali, America's greatest athlete pacifist, who ranks up there with America's greatest artist activist, Paul Robeson. And I'm equally enraged by the government's ass-kissing media and a nation of cowards now falling all over themselves to praise him. In 1970, at the height of the illegal Vietnam War, 95% of all these hypocritical cowards wanted Ali in jail for refusing to fight yellow colored people and pointing out that LBJ and McNamara were war criminals. Howard Cosell of ABC was one of the few Americans who gave him airtime, as did Flip Wilson. The day after, we gave Ali 90 minutes of free speaking airtime on AM Los Angeles. This one and only magnificent man is now buried in a country that did not deserve him, but needed him. He was without equal. In America today, there's not one amongst the rich and famous with the courage to talk truth to our government that Dr. King said was the greatest terrorist in the world. When threatened with jail and loss of income, Ali did not just talk truth, he shouted it. If there is a God, he should kick every soul out of heaven just to make room for Ali, because with Ali, when it comes to soul, God would have the company of the greatest. In our country now, with an economy and a culture and endlessly, needlessly warmongering government, which seems to be needed to be held together by duct tape, the four words I hear more than any other today from everybody, those four words are, where are today's heroes? Folks, there are many, but you will not hear much about them from a press that prints stuff less interesting than that which is found on toilet paper. Because if these heroes become too popular, as did the early Ali, the government and press will try to destroy and discredit them. Or if they become too popular, simply murder them and have their media call it case closed, as they did with John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and 48 years ago on a late June night, Robert Kennedy. A couple of weeks ago, we spent 2 hours with William Pepper, Sirhan Sirhan's attorney, who returns in 2 weeks. Tonight's guest was one of Robert Kennedy's best friends. One of five people shot in the pantry that night, 48 years ago, at the Ambassador Hotel. Folks, he is one of those heroes you were looking for. As the regional director of the Auto Workers Union in 1968, he was labor chair of Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign. When the Ambassador Hotel was torn down, he saw to it personally, in memory of Bobby, that on that ground, they built a school, which they did. The library is justifiably named in honor of our guest, who, along with William Pepper, is trying to get a new trial or parole for Sirhan. You can Google his brilliant, recent, logical, heartbreaking argument before that parole board in California. But it is better you hear it from him. It is an honor to welcome Paul Schrade. Paul, welcome to the show, and thank you.
Thank you, John.
Paul, when did you first meet Bobby, and how did you become involved in his campaign?
Well, I first met him in 1956, a very short story. He came out of the UAW, United Auto Workers, reception area at that Democratic convention in 1956. We were supporting Adlai Stevens and Keith Oliver, and I was with Walter Ruth, the president of our union, and we were walking towards the room, and out comes Jack and Bob Kennedy. And Jack comes up to Walter and says, "Walter, I need your support for the vice presidential nomination," which really failed. But Walter said to him, "Young man, you've got to change your voting record." So that was my first introduction to these rich kids.
That's funny. Did you become quite close to him or just casually close to him?
No, what happened in 60, I was working in Detroit as an administrative assistant with Ruther. president of our union, and he had already endorsed Jack Kennedy. And we were able to support anyone we pleased. So I was, you know, following up a third chance for Stevenson and did a number of things to help him in Michigan. But then he canceled on a convention we had organized for him with all labor of Michigan. And I called his guys and said, "What's happening?" And they said, "We don't know." And I said, "Well, I don't know if I can keep this up." So, but I went to Walter Reuther and said, "Look, Stevenson wants to be drafted for a third try at the presidency, and he's not going to make it, and Johnson's a big problem. So I'll support Jack Kennedy, even though he's not my favorite." And so Bob Kennedy asked me to go back to California and meet with the Stevenson delegates who I worked with during the 52-56 campaigns, and I was able to move some of them over to John Kennedy rather than Lyndon Johnson. So we were able to make an effort for John Kennedy at that point.
When John Kennedy was killed, did you have occasion to call Bobby, or did Bobby have occasion to call you?
No, we didn't communicate very much after that. He was really out of it. I was with him in meetings in Washington, and he came to Walter Reuther's brother's, Roy's, funeral. But he wouldn't really talk very much. He would just sort of sit with clenched hands, his head bowed, and he was just in terrible, terrible shape, and it took about a year for him to really begin responding to his, you know, to his family and to his friends.
When he finally decided to run for the presidency, did he then approach you, or did you approach him?
Well, I knew he was going to run because I was with him with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, the leaders of the farm worker movement up in Delano, California. Bob played a major role with them. I got him involved in that back in 65. And so at that end of the Chavez's fast, that's why we were there in Delano, Bob came out and spoke with 10,000 farm workers there. And that's when he told Cesar Chavez he's going to run. That was on Sunday, just before he announced. He announced then on the following Friday, and after his competitor, had a great vote against Johnson in New Hampshire. Forgetting that name already. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's you're talking about Gene McCarthy?
Gene McCarthy.
Yeah, okay. Now,
people always said, well, Bob Kennedy just got in there because Gene McCarthy did such a, had a nearly beat Johnson in New Hampshire. But Bob had already decided this. In fact, Johnson was tracking him all over the country because Bob was out meeting with people preparing to run. And so he actually told his staff and Cesar Chavez on the Sunday before that New Hampshire vote that he was going to run. So it's kind of a cheap shot that Gene McCarthy made it, Robert.
Just before Bobby won, or about the time that he won, and they went into the Ambassador Hotel, did you and he have any time at all alone to talk at all about your plans or about his thoughts?
Well, we had a lot of time together up on the fifth floor, which was where the family and friends were staying and where everybody gathered that night, the night that he had this California victory. I was in the bedroom with him talking with two of his main guys, Frank Mankiewicz and Fred Dutton, who were head of his campaign. And so we had that quiet time together to talk about what he ought to be talking about when he went down to make his victory speech, and to, you know, who he should mention and so forth. So we talked a lot through the evening, and he tried to call Walter Reuther at one point on the phone. I set him up for that. we kept talking about, you know, whether we could get Reuther over, because Reuther was still supporting Johnson, even though I wasn't. And we had good time together that evening.
Was there any time when Mankiewicz or you or Bobby ever mentioned that if he ever got into the White House that he might open up an investigation into the murder of his brother?
Well, he said it himself. He told people, there's a couple of references to that, and that we need to be in the White House in order to solve the John Kennedy case.
Okay, now
he said that himself. Yeah,
I see. Because he did have a liaison to Garrison's office, because Garrison told the liaison, as he told Mort Saul, he says, "You tell Bobby that whatever he knows, he should go public because he will save his life." And Bobby kept it kind of quiet because, as you said, he had to get into the White House. Okay, he's at the Ambassador Hotel. Every one of us was watching that night, and it was a magnificent, glorious night. I always had the impression, and I don't know where I got it, that when he left the stage to go back to wherever he was going, that somebody misdirected him into the pantry. Is that true?
Well, that's one of the conspiracy theories, which was not true. When he got he actually went on the stage from the front, and he went off the back of the stage, and that was a plan, because the strategy always was not to go the same place you came from, go back a different way. Well, when he got to the pantry area before going downstairs, which was where he's headed, to another ballroom where there was another 1,000 farm workers, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta were, they had a little conference right there for Dutton and Mankiewicz and Pierre Salinger, and point of their move towards the pantry was that the media were up against a New York deadline, and so that was the decision that was made by them at that point to go right to the Colonial Room through the pantry rather than left downstairs to the Ambassador Room.
Because
so that was a decision they made.
Well, the reason I bring that up, because if there is a conspiracy and a plot to murder Bobby Kennedy, and the killing will take place in the pantry, and they pre-put Sirhan in the pantry.
Well, that's an assumption you're making, which I don't make.
Yeah, yes, it's an assumption.
Now, it's maybe true, but we don't have evidence of that, and I don't go there, because conspiracy theorists, it's sort of a game with them, and you have to prove the conspiracy in order to make any headway. And that's why, if there was a conspiracy, I don't know about it. I don't talk about it. Otherwise, you're out of the contest. They then have the opportunity to keep the case covered up.
You're absolutely right. So now take us into the pantry, and what happened?
Well, I got there before he did. He came in without anybody with him. Actually, what happened, his bodyguard, Bill Barry, and Rafer Johnson, and Rosie Greer, were with Ethel, who was 3 months pregnant with Rory.
Oh.
And so they were protecting her, and he dashed ahead. He came up to me and said, "Paul, I want you and Jess Unruh, the chair of the California campaign, with me at this press conference." And he turned and started shaking hands with a couple of guys in the kitchen. And I remember being very close to them and seeing these guys in a way so glad to meet Robert Kennedy that, I felt it was like when he first met Cesar Chavez. Well, anyway, we turned and moved away from them, walking eastward, and that's when the television lights went on, and shots from Sirhan began. He fired 2 shots, missed Robert Kennedy, and I fell.
What did you see?
I didn't see anything.
Because of the lights and the fact that
The television lights just sort of blinded us.
Oh,
and I didn't know I'd been shot. I thought I was being electrocuted because I was shaking violently and passed out.
Oh my goodness gracious! So,
Bill Eppridge was I've talked to, he's died, but I talked to him a few years ago, and he says, I was following you into the kitchen and at the pantry area, and I saw you fall, and then I saw Bob fall. He said, you fell first, and that's why the pictures that I took for Life magazine show you on the floor first and then Bob.
Okay.
So that's
now,
all sort of gives us an idea of the sequence of the shooting at that point.
How long, Paul, before you were feeling better, and how long before you began to question the fact that Sirhan might have not been the killer of your friend?
Well, first of all, what I found out is that Bob was shot after I was. We know now by a second gunman. I didn't get involved in this case until 74. I was so out of it. I was depressed. I was angry. I was not doing my job as an officer of the United Auto Workers Union, and I lost my elective position, and I didn't care. I didn't want to do anything anymore. I just wanted sort of peace and quiet, and I moved out of the city. I moved up into the desert. But soon after that, I did co-chair the biggest peace rally in the country up in San Francisco in the Polo Grounds, along with Dalton Trumbo and Carl Reiner. I was co-chairing that. And that's when I met my wife. I began, you know, socializing with her and finally marrying her. And living. So I was really out of it for 1974 until Allard Lowenstein, former member of the Congress and on the Nixon enemies list. And
yeah, I remember Allard very well. Interviewed
head of the
Johnson
movement. Well, he said, look, Paul, you were a victim in this case. You've got status, and there are people who are raising questions. Robert Vaughn, for one, was raising questions about this with Allard. Two people that he took me to see the night he was here in 74, just four or five blocks from us here in his house, two people were actually investigating the case because friends of theirs had a photograph of two bullet holes in the door frames behind us and west of us in the pantry area, signifying a second gun.
Okay, how many bullet holes were supposed to be in the pantry?
Well, let me say, what I was able to do was file a lawsuit against Sirhan and any others to try to get information, which didn't come through. I filed another lawsuit, and CBS at the same time filed it, not knowing that I had filed. And we asked for a refiring of the Sirhan gun to match it against bullets that came from victims. There are only three such bullets, one from the back of Robert Kennedy, near his neck, a bullet from William Wiesel, and a bullet from one of the other wounded ones, Goldstein. What they found out, and which was really strange, was they couldn't match any of those three bullets to the Sirhan gun, and they, at least two of them should have. The Kennedy bullets.
Why was this not public knowledge?
It was public knowledge, but the press heard the report. Well, there's no evidence of a second gun, you know, and they ran out of the room like cub reporters. What they didn't say in here, it doesn't mean there wasn't a second gun, which
okay,
is what the
now,
seven experts said.
The business of the second gun, was this a conclusion that you came to because of Thomas Noguchi's autopsy or from some other evidence that...
Well, first of all, Thomas Noguchi is one of the heroes in this thing because he said after the autopsy, I've never said Sirhan was the only gunman that night, was the one who shot Robert Kennedy. And he got fired right in the middle of the trial because he had his information from the autopsy actually proved a second gunman. So he got fired right in the middle of the trial. He got reinstated a couple of months later with full back pay. He was innocent of this charge. And
at the time of the firing, Paul, myself and Noguchi's attorney headed up a committee, and we spoke at very crowded venues about trying to keep Noguchi as an independent coroner for the city of Los Angeles. And I testified at City Hall before the City Council. And, you know, I was just sort of a half-assed celebrity at the time, but I felt that he had said and reported in his autopsy report proved that there had to be a second gun.
Yeah.
Now, do you know possibly the identity of the second gunman, the security guard who was behind Bobby?
Well, the security guard is not a suspect in my way of thinking about this case. He is a person of interest because he was there. We found out later he hated the Kennedys. He picked up Robert Kennedy's arm after Carl Uecker, the maitre d', dropped it in order to capture Sirhan. He was saw the Sirhan gun 2 feet from Kennedy. He said the gun was 4 feet from him. So he was on the right side of Robert Kennedy holding his arm. And they said he pulled his gun when he saw this, but it was too late. Then he said he also fell, and they said he fell and then pulled his gun. So he had information that should have been put before the jury, but he was not even considered a person of interest, and he was not given the opportunity to tell his story to the jury. They excused him from testifying, which is part of the cover-up of the second gunman, because either he did it or he was close enough to the other person who did
because
he got powder in his eyes.
Then don't you have to conclude, with this kind of evidence being suppressed, do you not have to conclude that the authorities somehow were conspiring to conceal the murderers of Bobby Kennedy?
I don't know about murders, more than one, but we know there was one. And we've got to stick to the facts in this case. And that's why I consider myself the prosecutor of the prosecutors at this point. I'm accusing them of covering up the fact that Sirhan couldn't and didn't shoot Robert Kennedy, and covering up the fact the second gunman shot Robert Kennedy. Why I stick carefully with the evidence. I don't accuse Thane Eugene Caesar. I don't talk about conspiracies. I want to use the evidence that they had, or evidence they destroyed, that proved the second gunman. And that's the way to approach this case.
Absolutely. But then you have to conclude, if they're suppressing this evidence and destroying this evidence, they are conspiring to hide the murder of Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, well, that's a conspiracy I can deal with.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Now,
there was that conspiracy of the prosecution. They deliberately did this. It wasn't by error. They deliberately framed Sirhan, who tried to shoot Robert Kennedy. He shot me and 4 other people, but he did not shoot Robert Kennedy. The second gunman shot Robert Kennedy. And
okay.
That's what we're aiming at at this point with the prosecution, to force them to give a whole new investigation of this case based upon their own evidence.
Well, it seems to me that Sirhan, as William Pepper says, seems to be a political prisoner because his constitutional rights were violated by the opening arguments of, was it Cooper, the guy who represented him and told the jury the guy's guilty?
Their strategy was to try to prove, to try to give him a chance for a life sentence and not being sent to the gas chamber at San Quentin. That was their strategy. They say, look, he's guilty, therefore, but he deserves to be given a life sentence and not execution. That was their strategy. It was a bad strategy, and they didn't investigate, and they were told some of the problems with the case by people that were able to talk to them. They just gave him a bad deal.
Well, now he's
suffering for it now. As far so he's and as far as being a political prisoner, we don't have to invent that term. The head of the parole board on February 10th, when I appeared there, said that he was a political prisoner, and it's in the transcript.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Now, it seems to me you have a new generation of police officers in Los Angeles. You have a new generation of the judicial in front of whom you present your case. I read two or three times your brilliant presentation to the parole board. You must have been shocked when they turned him down.
No, I wasn't. They've done it over and over and over again, and I was angry. In fact, I was out of control. I've never been that angry and trying to do something. I had a real difficult problem presenting the information, but I got it out there. But the problem with the parole board, they can't sort of retry the case, although they could consider the evidence and say, well, he's eligible for parole.
So this is why we
have to go back to the current district attorney and police chief and say to them, we want a new investigation. In fact, the district attorney now has an innocence project in work in her operation. And it's possible that Sirhan could go there and maybe get consideration. But again, we've been to the district attorney where she was number two with Steve Cooley, and they totally closed the door on us. And the police chief, presently, we went to him, gave him all of our evidence. He wouldn't meet with us, wouldn't even answer our mail. He wouldn't say he got the reports that we sent him. So they've closed the door on us, and this is why we have to do something political and public, as well as do everything we can with lawyers.
What is it that you can do that's political? What is it that you can do that is now political and public? It just seems to me that these people, new people who are turning you down, aren't doing it on their own. They must be getting orders from someplace else that this young man or old man now has to remain a political prisoner. So what is it that you could do now? Because William Pepper said that he has sort of a secret card up his sleeve that is extra legal, as he said, that might get him a new trial. What is it that you can do now?
Well, first of all, this is where I'm very pessimistic about the courts. The Sirhan case has been in the court since 1972, and the courts have turned down every lawyer, including Bill and Laurie Dusek, his partner on the case. And the courts are not going to do anything. Now, he may have a better plan, and I hope he does, but again, the courts are not going to do anything. The most liberal Ninth Circuit Court in the country here in California turned down Pepper and Dusek on the Sirhan case.
Are there any prominent personages, any famous movie stars, or any famous politician who can come to you and say, hey, let me take you down here again, and we're going to have a press conference and say that they should open this thing up? Has anybody come to help you?
Well, no, there's a lot of help out there, and we will organize it. My job is to make the case that the prosecution covered up Sirhan's failure to shoot Robert Kennedy, and also covered up the evidence about the second gunman. There's so much evidence on the record here that I have that can be presented publicly. Now, I'll get this to Jackie Lacey, the new district attorney, who happens to be a Democrat but has still closed the door on us, to Chief Beck, but also to the police commission, which has control over the police chief, to the county board of supervisors, has some control over the district attorney, and the L.A. City Council, where I've got friends, political friends, and there are a lot of people who will be supporting on this. Robert Kennedy Jr. sent a when we tried to get U.S. Attorney General Holder involved in this case. He sent a letter to Holder to ask him to support me and our group to reopen the case. So they're really good allies out there.
Why doesn't Bobby Kennedy Jr., instead of sending a letter, why doesn't he come out to Los Angeles and stand in front of City Hall and say, this case has to be reopened?
We'll get him involved in this. He doesn't have to come to Los Angeles. He lives in Los Angeles. Rory Kennedy, and another daughter of Ethel's and Bob's, is here, and so is Max Kennedy. But Bobby will help us. He understands the case. He's a good lawyer, been a deputy DA in New York, and I'm relying on him.
Okay, now, last question.
That's where, you know, our first step has got to be to make this whole thing public.
Could you get it in a broad
brush way downtown, you know?
Would it be possible for you, when you go to the police commission, which has control, as you say, over the police chief, would it be possible to get that televised live?
No, that's up to the police commission, but they have done that. We did have a...
Then I suggest...
When we found out
that
Evel Younger, the district attorney, says there's going to be full disclosure of all the files over there in the police department. There's tons of evidence over there. When we face that... Then he closed down the files because these two people in our neighborhood who were on the case exposed the fact that the bullet holes in the door frames. Well, we found out rather than get full disclosure, there was a full lockup soon after the trial because they had destroyed the ceiling panels and the door frames with the bullet holes.
Okay,
and
when
so,
you go before the commission, my suggestion would be if you cannot get it televised publicly because they don't give permission.
We did get full coverage of our appearance before the police commission in 1988 when we got them finally to release all the files.
Okay.
You
should bring in cameras and film it all, even though it's not going public, so you have that visual record of it. Then you can go on public access
television. I think the intensity and the strength of our case is such that the media will be on the job on this one.
Well, I wouldn't trust the media in America, frankly.
Of course not.
And then the other thing is, because you got so angry, and you're a very bright, a very accomplished, very successful American citizen, and you are trying to do something really legal, which the legal system is preventing you from doing. Why should any American pay any attention to the government of the United States and their laws, which they don't even implement themselves?
Well, we have that both internally and internationally, where we don't follow the law.
Well, Mr. Schrade, I must tell you, my hat is off to you. You are just terrific. You are one of the heroes, and I hope to hear more about what it is you're doing. I hope, and I will certainly get an update on that when William Pepper is here in a couple of weeks. And again, I want to thank you truly, truly, truly. You are a phenomenal public servant. You are a little bit like Don Quixote, but you're still out there tilting at those windmills. That's exactly right. And again, thank you so much for being here. And if there's anything at all that we could do here, I mean, I still have a lot of contact with Tom Noguchi. We still remain friends. And if there's anything in any way that I could do, either publicly or privately or financially, I'd be happy to help you. Okay?
Yeah, well, we have to admire Noguchi for what he did and hate what they did to him and what they did to the case by ignoring him. It's...
Look what they did to Mort Saul when he went to help Jim Garrison in New Orleans. Paul, thank you so much. Thank you for doing this again. And I hope you will come back after you have these hearings and appear here again, because I would just love to talk to you some more.
Do you put your program online?
Well, it's if you go to the archives, you can access it. I don't know if it goes.
Okay.
I am sort of technically challenged.
You're not alone.
No, listen, I am Forrest Gump when it comes to this kind of stuff. But I have the best engineers in the world, the best producer in the world, Mike Kim, who is our producer, and Don and Doug Newsom, who own BBS, are brilliant engineers.
Yeah.
And they will put it online. I'm sure it's online, but it is available in the archives.
You got a big and a good voice. So,
well,
that's not as good
and not as meaningful as yours. And I'm just glad that I can give you a little megaphone here so it can be heard more.
Thank you. We'll talk to you shortly.
Bye bye.
Right.
We'll be right back with the brightest journalist in America, Joe Satilli.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you, thank you. I want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited review of The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can get on Amazon, and the funds from the sale of that. And amazingly, 30 or 40 or 50 of those things, they sell every month only on word of mouth, because that's how good it is. But the funds raised by that are going into part two. And in part two, one of the four people, brilliant people who are helping me put this together, fortunately, is my regular here, publishes the best newsletter in America daily. It's called News Vandal, and nobody is better than Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show, and your thoughts on what you heard from Paul.
Well, first of all, you have three other members on the team for the second assassination who are certainly far more knowledgeable and more adept than I. But, you know, the thing that struck me about your conversation with Mr. Schrady was this idea about conspiracy. I do love that he continually came back to just the facts, ma'am, just the facts, you know, Joe Friday. Jack Webb is Joe Friday. So, you know, you have this desire to stick to the facts because he feels that the facts alone indicate that there was a second shooter, or that at least Sirhan Sirhan did not fire the shot that killed his friend and
yes, but
ally.
Then you have to conclude that the suppression from the law, from the courts, and from the police chief, and from the district attorney saying, we're turning our backs on you regardless of the facts, you have to come to the conclusion that they aren't doing that of their own volition. You have to come to the conclusion that there are forces above them saying he will remain, as what Paul said, was a political prisoner.
Well, I think you can certainly make that conclusion over the course of Sirhan's first 10 or 15 years of imprisonment. But I think what happens with a lot of these systems is that you have the initial jury rigging of whatever the outcome the people people in power, whatever they want, they can jury rig that outcome, they can get it, and then it almost becomes enshrined. And I think over time, these things take on a life of their own. So when you get 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road, the people who are charged with the duty of giving a fair hearing to Sirhan in this case don't want to be the person who actually cries foul on everything that came before it. Remember, America's judicial system runs off of precedent. And once precedent is set, it's very hard to break precedent. I think this is one of the tools that covert operators, and that's what I tend to call them, covert operators, because to say the government, it's such a big thing, the government, because really it's the government within the government.
Yes, but Joe, what you are saying, if it's all based on precedent, where are the original thinkers in jurisprudence?
I think they've been driven out over time, or things have become so politicized that the original thinkers are actually the people who are most likely to identify with a specific ideological bent, like Antonin Scalia, and then become icons of an ideological approach to jurisprudence, as opposed to, like, my great hero in American jurisprudence is Justice Hugo Black, who, he was in the South, and he wanted to run for office, and he had to join the Klan, and then that ended up becoming a stain. And over the course of Hugo Black's life, he became one of the great advocates of civil rights and of civil rights for African Americans. Another great example is Justice Souter, right?
How about William O. Douglas?
And William O. Douglas. You have these people who evolve in the role, and I don't think that we get that very much anymore because everything is so hyper-politicized. I think in no small part because of that earthquake event.
You want to know something? You look at every one of these car commercials that you see. What is it that they tell you they're doing? They're being independent free thinkers.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, that is the last thing the people who run this country want from American citizens is independent free thinkers.
No, they want it, but they want it in consumer choices. They want you to be an independent free thinker when you're choosing between 13 types of frozen pizza or 7 types of Raisin Bran.
So that's what you were telling me. There are no writers in America. There are no lawyers in America who want to be America's Emile Zola and hunt out the truth of what has happened with Sirhan Sirhan. They have this wonderful evidence that Paul has. They have this wonderful evidence that his lawyer Pepper has. Somebody has to say, hey, hang on a minute here. These are the facts. This kid didn't do this.
Well, how about this, John? And this is something you and I have discussed many times. And I think it actually comes back to the carrot and the stick. And it's not so much that you have to direct people in charge of a parole hearing to rule a certain way. It's that over time, people have realized that the rewards for ruling the way the system wants you to rule are very, very great. And the punishments for ruling against it are also very, very terrible. And so over time, this is very much the case in journalism. One of the reasons why people don't ask questions, and now there are people who actively don't ask questions, like Chris Matthews and the way Peter Jennings handled his special, for example, and Dan Rather. I think these are people who are probably co-opted somewhere along the way. I mean, we don't have evidence of that, but we have a lot of circumstantial evidence. But I think for the people who are not co-opted, they know that if they ask the question about RFK, about MLK, about Malcolm X, about even George Wallace, the fact, you know, the oddity of George Wallace's killer, his notebooks actually become the outline for Paul Schrader's script for Taxi Driver, and Taxi Driver becomes kind of a blueprint for John Hinckley Jr., who ends up shooting Ronald Reagan. And had he been successful, John Hinckley Jr.'s dad's friend and person who his dad had given money to as a political during political campaigns, George Herbert Walker Bush, would have become president. Well, we don't ask those questions. You know, Roger Mudd, I believe it was the only person to bring up the connection between the Hinckleys and the Bush family on the day Reagan was shot. And then no other question was ever asked again. Was it because there was a direction, or was it because over time people realized, can't go there because our careers would be over?
Okay. Bobby Kennedy's murder was a political murder.
Absolutely. And by the way, John, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Bobby Kennedy running for president, because my mother, a good Irish Catholic girl from Eugene, Oregon, actually came down to California from Eugene to work on his campaign, and then met my biological father, and I was born in August of 1969.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, you know that my first appearance on The Tonight Show was the night after Bobby Kennedy was murdered.
Oh, you told me this story. You got to let people know about this.
Well, I don't want to talk about it right now, but I will some other time. What I want to talk about is some other deaths. And because you lead off your wonderful news vandal with the increasing violence against the lesbian gay community, so I want you to expand on that, what you have in your news vandal.
Well, I mean, I had to go long today on it, and there are so many different ways to go. And, you know, today you had the oddity of Donald Trump going full force and turning it into a political campaign issue, as is expected, and intimating on Fox and Friends that President Obama either doesn't know what's going on, or there's something else up, implying that Obama is a secret Muslim agent who is allowing these people to come in. I swear he did this on Fox and Friends this morning. The other thing that he did is he went off on how we have to protect the rights of the LGBT community and their right to love who they want. And so now you have this interesting situation where the Republican Party, which has been staunchly anti-gay rights, has been staunchly anti-gay marriage, has a large evangelical contingent in it. You have Westboro Baptist Church. You have you have Pat Robertson, who started the Christian Coalition. And Pat Robertson regularly says that the reason why we had Katrina is because Disneyland allowed homosexuals to cavort at their theme park.
Oh,
so now you have a thing in the Republican Party where once again Donald Trump is actually forcing their heads to explode at some point, because haven't they all been virulently anti-gay? But now that they've been killed by a supposed Muslim extremist, now we have to embrace them because they were killed by Muslims, and we got to choose Muslims over gays and lesbians. What are we doing? Oh my gosh.
I recall when 9/11 happened, I think it was Buchanan or one of these evangelists, born-againers, who has his own show or his own network, a religious network, saying that 9/11 happened because of all the gays in New York.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Do you recall that?
Yes. And that, I think that was John Hagee, who I've watched often. He's a fire and brimstone guy who also believes that if we could just knock down the Al-Aqsa Mosque that's there on the Temple on the Mount, that it would turn into a helipad, a landing pad for Jesus, and he would come back and, you know, take all of his followers back up with him after defeating Satan at Armageddon.
Why do you think there seems to be increased homophobia in the country?
Because there's increased homosexual acceptance, and I think that this is one of the things that happens as they become more accepted and more predominant and more prevalent and more noticeable in society. The people who remain, who are clinging to an ancient taboo that was developed 4,000 years ago and was written in Leviticus, they become more virulently opposed to it as it becomes more widely accepted and normal in society, alas.
Well, I understand that there's still 18 states in America where sex with sheep is not illegal.
Well, you know, if it's a lamb, you can sacrifice that lamb after you sodomize it to God in the Allah, the Old Testament, and maybe you can make everything right again.
Okay. What is it that you would like to expand on that you really are pleased with and interested in the news vandal today?
Well, I think the thing that I led off with, which was a great piece in The Atlantic, which talked about the long-standing and relentless attack on LGBT individuals in America, homophobic violence, which has gone on for a long time, which has gone unnoticed, and it's great that it's being noticed now. I caution people to get too caught up in the terrorism side of this and not see that there's a homophobic side of this, because we just now had a story breaking that Omar Mateen had been seen more than once at the Pulse Club drinking, so he had gone to that club. And you always wonder, the people who are the most virulently homophobic are probably the people who are themselves homosexuals.
I was just going to say that he probably, maybe he was rebuffed by somebody there and went back to do them in. You know, it is astonishing, you know, how many people, how many males that I have run across who seem to... Oh, okay, I don't want to get into that. I just don't want to get into that. But anyway, it is sad, so sad, that the business that we are forced to accept of becoming more tolerant of gays and lesbians is nonsense. We should be tolerant of everybody. And we shouldn't be reminded of it because some madman in Florida, for whatever reason, he did what he did. Anyway, Joe, thank you again. Where can people hear you now? How can they get your news vandal?
Well, just go to newsvandal.com. It's spelled just like it sounds, and you can sign up for the rundown. And I'll be on Ocelli's show, Chuck Ocelli's show, tomorrow from 6 to 7. That's on American Freedom Radio, 6 to 7 Pacific. And then I'll have Inside the Headlines at 2 p.m. on KRUU-FM. You can listen online to KRUU-FM. And John, as ever, great to be with you.
Oh, you are by far the best, and I hope you end up getting your own internet show or your own network radio show or something, because you really, aside from being a terrific writer, you communicate and talk so wonderfully. So thank you. I want to thank Doug and Don Newsom, who own this wonderful BBS network, and Mike Kim, without whom I could not do this show, and especially all of you, all of the good words that you send. Thank you so much. Good luck, good night, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.